From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, Mongrel Nation, the America Begotten by Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. It's a new book on interracial relations written by a local history professor. Also, actor Tyler Coppin takes his internationally acclaimed one-man play to Sacramento. He was born here but has spent his adult life in Australia. But first, the long-running tension between horse riders and motorcyclists on public lands grew serious early last month on a trail at Folsom Lake. Two women on horses encountered three motorbike riders. The animals bolted and both riders fell. One of the horses suffered a fractured leg and was euthanized. Various vehicles and animals have access to trails and public lands, and when trails are narrow, steep and winding, things can get crowded, even dangerous. We're going to talk today about the general issue of safety and access rights on public lands, particularly involving horses and motorbikes. We're going to start with Barbara Hayward, who was one of the horse riders involved in that incident at Folsom Lake. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what happened that morning. You and your friend Jerry Sust went out for a horse ride in the Folsom Lake State Recreation Area. What happened?
We did. We were out for about an hour. There's long stretches of horse trail that are pretty remote from anything. And we turned a corner, and behind us, turning the corner after us, were motorbikes. The last one, the horses, of course, get tense and worried because they're concerned with something that close. The last one was very close. And I imagine the horses thought it was after them, attacking them. They panicked, bolted, and when they turned a sharp corner to get away, we were thrown. We couldn't quite sit that out. So she had her helmet smashed. Lucky she had her helmet. And I cracked four ribs, and the horses took off. And then later, we were able to track down her horse with a his leg was injured so badly that he had to be euthanized on the beach later. And, of course, it was a long afternoon tracking down the other horse and trying to get help.
What about the motorbike riders? Did you see them again?
Well, it's hard to say. Once, possibly, but not clearly. It was hard. It was, you know, we had to deal first with her, with her smashed helmet, and then try to find the horses. I mean, it was, we had to do things in order and try to deal with the emergency and then, you know.
Do you recall the motorbike riders acknowledging you or your horses or anything like that?
I don't.
Have you often taken horses to that area?
I have ridden, I estimated, I think I said 3,100 times. I've been here 14 years. I go three times a week. I've been down there all the time and in very similar places and just innumerable times on the trails.
How often have you seen, heard, had interaction with motorbikes?
This has been recent. Motorbikes in this area where they're not allowed at all, that we do run into bicycles, mountain bikers, and that's, you know, sometimes a problem, sometimes not. But motorbikes are totally disallowed on the lake bed property. And this is one of the unfortunate times. It was very severe.
We're talking about safety and access on public lands, specifically prompted by an incident in early January at Folsom Lake State Recreation Area when two women riding their horses had an encounter with three young men on dirt bikes. The horses bolted, one of the horses fractured its leg and was euthanized. The two women were injured. Janet Peterson is also with us. She's president of ACE, that stands for Action Coalition of Equestrians. Janet, welcome.
Thank you.
How unusual a situation is this, where you have dirt bikes coming in contact with horses and someone or some creature gets injured?
I think it's incredibly frequent. Many of them actually turn out to be near misses, scary events, things that go, in essence, unreported. The cyclists themselves, the motorcyclists, are very hard to catch, chase down. And when you are the equestrian, your very first reaction is your horse's safety and your safety. You are not paying attention directly to the cyclists or the the perpetrators themselves.
What do you and other equestrians recommend that people riding horses in areas like Folsom Lake do when it comes to encounters with motorbikes?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the best things they can do, every equestrian out there should certainly be carrying a cell phone. And in order to help state parks and other land managers, you know, corral situations like this, for them to report anything and everything that they see. It could be a downed tree. It could be something else that's safety related. But by all means, if you have mountain bikes or motorcyclists riding on illegal trails, in other words, trails that are specifically designated for hikers and equestrians, those need to be reported. Those agencies need to know how frequently this is happening, but also they need to know where and when it's happening so that they can dispatch resources to help take care of it.
On the phone is Dan Tynan, who's Folsom Lake Sector Superintendent for California State Parks. That agency is responsible for enforcing trail regulations. Dan Tynan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Can you tell us about the respective rights of horse riders, of motorbike riders, and for that matter, mountain bikes in the Folsom Lake recreation area?
Well, first, I'd just like to say that we never allow or condone illegal off-road activity inside the state recreation area. Folsom Lake is, it's roughly 19,500 acres inside the park, and we've got 100 miles of trails. And we've got limited staff. We've got limited staffing in rangers, maintenance, and resource scientists that are out there to protect the environment and provide for public access. The park is, when we do get illegal activity, just like was it Janet? She just said that we encourage people to use their cell phones and be good witnesses out there. We depend on that because there are a lot of areas in our park that are very remote. It takes even our ranger staff, once they're dispatched, anywhere from 15 to 20 to 30 minutes to get back in there.
Do dirt bikes have any right to be anywhere inside the Folsom Lake recreation area?
No, they do not. And we are trying to, with the help of the equestrians, who have been really great since this incident took place. We've met with each other, and we're trying to increased and upgrade signage in the park, fencing. Unfortunately, Folsom is accessible anywhere around the lake. With the low water levels right now, it even increases that surface area for people to come in and a lot more areas for people to ride, so it seems to be more attractive. What we're asking people to do is be good witnesses out there, and when they spot the activity, to call it in, and we can get somebody out there to take care of it.
What about the access rights of horses and other people with other means of getting around, mountain bikes and whatever else?
Well, we do have staging areas throughout the north portion of the lake and up different areas. Most people know where they're at. And for the responsible and people that want to use the park, obviously that's great for them. Unfortunately, some of these areas also are kind of tucked in there. And if someone wants to go in there and launch a motorcycle out off there, off some of the areas, then they do, and they can go in there real quick and get out quicker than we can get there.
Yes. Janet Peterson, do you want to respond to what Dan Tynan's been saying?
I do. I think that it's absolutely true that the water level has certainly aggravated this situation. But I think if you look at the bigger picture, which is trail conflict in general, that is a situation that has gone unaddressed or insufficiently addressed for a very, very long time. This is just simply the most recent flashpoint, and it could have been, you know, any number of other kinds of encounters that ended in exactly the same way.
Well, what do you think should be done? And bear in mind, of course, the size of the area, the length of the trails, and not to mention the state's tremendous financial problems.
No, I think that there are some immediate things that can be done, and a lot of it costs nothing. I think the trail users themselves offer a tremendous service to any land manager, because remember, this is not just state parks. This is also the U.S. Forest Service. It's also the Bureau of Land Management. Many of the cities around here have trails of this nature, and so do the counties. So it is across all agencies that trail users can be of great service by, one, there is a set of universal trail etiquette standards, and follow those. A lot of that boils down to right of way. The horse always has the right of way. It is first in line for right of way. Second in line would be the pedestrian, and the mechanized mode of transportation is always last. The motorcycle or the motorbike yields the right of way to the other two in sequential order.
And how is that determined, that order of priority?
Well, you know, the horse is the more difficult one to maneuver. They take a little bit more space and they take a little bit more time. So to have the other two types of trail users just pause so that we can maneuver our horse, let's say, off the trail and out of the way so somebody can pass, or maneuver so that we can turn around and face a mountain bike that's coming towards us. That's why the horse primarily has the first right of way.
Okay. Also on the phone is Dawn Amador, who's Western Representative for the Blue Ribbon Coalition. That's an advocacy group for motorized recreation on public lands. Dawn Amador, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And, you know, this is a pretty serious issue, and Blue Ribbon first wants to extend our deep regret to the people that were injured in this event, and certainly we don't condone illegal use. You know, and we actually look forward to, you know, trying to work with the state and some of the equestrian groups and motorized groups to maybe form some sort of a stakeholders group where we can, you know, come together and see if we can address these issues. Because
how would you do that?
Well, I mean, you know, I've talked personally with Daphne Green, who's the deputy director of the state OHV program at state parks, also with Dave Pickett with the American Motorcycle Association. And I think we'd start off by having some sort of a round table, probably meet at Prairie City, which is a state vehicular recreation area close by, and see if we can, you know, find a way to address these issues. And I think we can find some solutions, but it's going to take some work.
In your opinion, Don, can motorbikes and horses, not to mention hikers and mountain bike riders, can they coexist on the same trail?
Well, they can if they respect each other. And I've seen places, multiple use trails everywhere from the Downeyville trails up by north of Nevada City to Idaho, where you have shared use trails. But like I think it was Janet that said, you've got to follow the rules of the road or rules of the trail, respect the other trail users, and I think then you can have co-use of certain trails. But certainly in places like the Folsom Lake Recreation Area, I think we need to do a better job of getting the word out not to ride there and use the legal facilities that are close by.
So just to make sure I understand you correctly, you're not suggesting then to introduce motorbikes to the Folsom Lake State Recreation Area?
No, they have other legal areas to ride in that are close by, and that's where, you know, we want to see them utilize those facilities and let the equestrians use the Folsom Lake trails.
Let's go back to Barbara Hayward. Barbara, if you were riding your horse in an area where motorbikes were allowed, would you ride your horse there?
One of my pastures is next to a busy road with motorcycles, and my horses, I feed them down there. They don't even lift their heads when the fire engine goes by. But if one of those vehicles were to come into the pasture, they would panic and run. So, no, I would not ride them. I would choose not to ride. A horse could be police train their horses to get used to this, but I don't want to. I don't like the noise.
Now, Dawn, I understand that you enjoy off-road motorbike riding. Have you ridden your motorbike on trails where there were also horses? And what was your experience, if you did?
Well, yes, particularly up in the Downeyville area where you have motorcycles and mountain bikes and equestrians using a lot of the same trails. And, you know, what we do is stop when we see a horse, take our helmet off so the horse can see that we're a person, and, you know, let them pass by. Those are sort of the trail etiquette that we support. And we also actually have Blue Ribbon. One of our representatives actually is an equestrian themselves, and he actually spends time training his horses to be around, you know, motorcycles and mountain bikes. So those are maybe some of the things that we can look at.
Let's go back to Dan Tynan at Folsom Lake for California State Parks. Dan, earlier Janet Peterson talked about the standard order of priority horses, then pedestrians, and then other forms of transportation. Do you agree with that interpretation of the rules of the trail?
Oh, absolutely. I think that if people work in mutual cooperation with one another, and that takes education, takes some communication with one another. And since this incident has happened, so many people stepped forward, not only from the equestrian community, but from the OHV community, and said, look, we don't want anybody to get a black eye out of this. And there's been only a few people that are out there illegally doing this type of activity. And those few people are hurting the rest of the users. When we've met with equestrians, we've met with pedestrians and mountain bikers who use the trail, and everybody's in favor of getting together and establishing some guidelines and some some common courtesies for one another using the trails out there at Folsom.
I have a hunch that there are a lot of people, not just people riding dirt bikes in places where they shouldn't be, who don't know about the order of priority on the trails. And I'm not talking here about people who are looking for trouble, but just people who are using these areas and don't know what the normal order of priority is, or might have a different interpretation of it. What can be done about this? Let's start with Janet Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the etiquette rules are frequently posted. They are, in a lot of respects, very, very similar to rules of the road. They're not terribly different from that. They also, kind of follow common courtesy. They're not pulled out of thin air and are, sort of vague, a vague list of rules. But I do think that the idea of cooperation among the groups and getting together and talking these things out is entirely possible. I will say that many, many, many groups like that have formed and discussed things, and quite frankly, there's not a lot that has changed as a direct result of that, and that's for a variety of different kinds of reasons. The problem proliferates because there is an element, and I wouldn't put a number on it, but there is an element, regardless of how educated they are intent on having an experience of their own design on the trails, and they are not out there with the intent of being courteous to anyone else. It's not that they don't know. I've run into many people on the trails. They were not courteous, and they weren't following etiquette, but they didn't know. And if you stop and you just speak to those people and explain why the rules are the way they are in complete compliance. No problem. You'll never see them again doing whatever it was that they were doing. But there is very definitely an element that is out there to do precisely what they want, when they want to do it.
Are you talking about motorbike riders specifically, or others too?
I would add the motorcycle riders, absolutely. There is no way that you enter Folsom Lake on a motorcycle without knowing that it's illegal, without knowing that when you come flying up behind a horse, that you're going to cause a serious situation.
As someone who's personally been on trails many, many times in my life, I think I've had bad experiences with other hikers, horses, dirt bikes, and mountain bike riders. So let's wrap up this conversation with final thoughts about what can be done in general. Let's start with Don Amador at the Blue Ribbon Coalition.
Okay, I think we've got two things here. I think we all can agree that we need to try to work better together, and I think we're headed in that direction. But I think more importantly, addressing illegal use, I think both Janet and Dan talked about reporting those incidents and how important that is for the parks then to know this is an area we need to have targeted law enforcement, and targeted law enforcement does work and is something that the motorized community would support.
Dan Tynan at Folsom Lake.
Well, I agree. Our immediate solutions are focused patrol out there, which we've already done, and we've put signage up, and we've had a significant decrease right now in the at least the off-road activity. Fencing and signage is very important out there, and that we need to designate our boundaries so that they can be determined what's private property, what's county property, and what's state park property.
And do you have fewer staff members nowadays?
We haven't been able to hire. We do have open positions as far as our ranger staff goes. Like everybody else in the state, we do have our minimum amount of patrol that we can perform out there right now.
Yeah, and we'll give the final word to Barbara Hayward. And Barbara, when you give us your final thoughts, tell us if you've been back with your horse to Folsom Lake State Recreation Area since this unfortunate incident.
Yes, I have. Not for a while, because it takes a while for ribs to heal up, but I did go back twice so far this past week, and it was a little tense, but we managed okay. And I will say that they are the most beautiful trails. It's worth all the nerve it takes to go, because it's extraordinary property.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us today. In our studio, Barbara Hayward, you just heard her, a horse rider who was injured in a January 3rd incident with motorbike riders illegally at the Folsom Lake State Recreation Area. Janet Peterson, who's president of Action Coalition of Equestrians. Dan Tynan on the phone, Folsom Lake Sector Superintendent for California State Parks. And Don Amador, Western Representative for the Blue Ribbon Coalition, an advocacy group for motorized recreation on public lands. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a new book on interracial relations by a local history professor. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. Charles Darwin's 200th birthday is coming up, also the 150th anniversary of his famous book on the origin of species. Monday on Insight, we'll talk with experts about Darwin's work and its impact on science and society. Also, a local poet finishes his final book of Pablo Neruda translations. William O'Daly tells you about World's End, the eighth volume of his two-decade-long Neruda project. Mongrel Nation, the America begotten by Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, is a new book about this country's history and legacy of interracial relationships. The author is a local history professor. Clarence Walker teaches at UC Davis. His specialties include Black American history from 1450 to the present. Clarence Walker, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How well known was the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings at the time?
Well, it was well known amongst the Black people at Monticello, but there was this silence in amongst the Virginia aristocracy, and it only becomes an issue in 1803 when a Scots newspaperman whom Jefferson had befriended, named Thomas Callender, starts making all of these accusations publicly.
This was Jefferson's friend.
Yes. Well, he was not really a friend. He was sort of like a political patron of some sort, you know. That Jefferson had provided him with money and taken care of him. And Callender became quite angry with Jefferson when Jefferson didn't give him a patronage post. And that's what I was trying to get at.
I see. So Callender was trying to embarrass Jefferson.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just not embarrass. I think that's a bit modest. I think he was trying to ruin him. The thought that the third president of the United States was sleeping with one of his slaves was just not, you know, kosher in any way. It was not acceptable at all.
How did Jefferson respond?
He responded with deadly silence. This relationship lasted for 38 years, and he never talked about it.
I see. How did Jefferson's white peers react to this accusation?
Well, it became deeply embroiled in politics, and the Federalists used it against Jefferson, but Jefferson's party, the National Republicans, all denied it and said it was not true and that it was just purely, you know, scurrilous and scandalous, you know, gossip designed to destroy the reputation of a great man. I mean, Jefferson's place in the pantheon of the founding fathers is quite simply, I think, that he really sort of embodies America. He is thought of as America itself, you know, the author of the Declaration of Independence, one of the founding fathers, the person who helped construct the Constitution, etc.
Behind closed doors, what do you think Jefferson's white peers said about this?
I think they probably said nothing about it, since it was common for aristocrats to sleep with lower class and lower people, racial people who were not of their class, I mean, in the 18th century. And I tend to think that one of the problems with the historiography of this issue has been, of course, the fact that the older generation of American historians who wrote about this thought of it as unthinkable and thought of it as something that Jefferson would not have done. But I think that what they're saying is that they would not have done it, and therefore Jefferson would not do it.
But you also say that it was not unusual.
No, it's not unusual. It's normative, as I argue.
So why was there so much denial about something that was common?
I think the denial has to do with the racial aspect of it, is that it was perfectly okay for these people to do these sorts of things, but it was not perfectly okay for them to go around publicly advertising it. It was an open secret.
Why did they think it was okay to have sexual relations, and for all I know, maybe even romantic relations, with people who they thought so little of that they enslaved them?
Well, Jefferson and his relationship to the Hemings, as I try to explain, is a very, 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 very interesting in the sense that Sally Hemings was Thomas Jefferson's wife's half-sister. Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law was Sally Hemings's father.
Oh, my goodness.
And in this family, before Jefferson, the father had slept with a black woman and purchased her from another white man, the family of slaves from another white man who'd had relationships with black women. And so this was not unusual on this group, this social group. And in the case of Jefferson, when his wife died, he took up with Sally Hemings when she was 15 years of age.
My guest is Clarence Walker. He's a history professor at UC Davis. He's the author of the new book just published today, Mongrel Nation, The America Begotten by Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Why were interracial relationships so common? Was there...
Well, they're common amongst the aristocracy, but they're also common amongst the lower classes, too. I think, first of all, there is a question of men being on the frontier and there being few white women around. There is also the case of just the pure attraction of these people to others. And I think, you know, one of the points that has to be kept in mind is that Sally Hemings was an octoroon. She was only one-eighth black. One-eighth black. And so she's not physically necessarily Negroid-looking, because the family, and particularly it would appear that the women in this family, the black women in this family, had been sleeping with white men for a long time for the purpose of getting the children produced of these unions free. That in the case of Jefferson and Hemings, there seems to have been some kind of agreement that he would free her children at a particular time. And three of the children that resulted from this union, Madison, Beverly, and Harriet, all were freed by Jefferson.
So at that time in America, and I'm sure it's still true today, even more so, there must have been all manner of people going around with various amounts of European and African ancestry in them.
Not just European and African, but Indian also.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a sort of, you know, if you think of a bouillabaisse or a potpourri, this was a very mixed race group of people. I mean, the products of these unions. And so the Hemings themselves, from what the record would indicate, approach or look white. And so they can pass into the mainstream of American society without there being any difficulty.
How did the white parents of children who are the product of an interracial relationship, how did those white fathers treat those children? I mean, on the one hand, you've got this natural bond between a parent and a child.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you've got this racial separation that was so acute, or at least officially so acute at that
time.
Well,
I tend to think that in the case of Jefferson, and Jefferson writes about this, Jefferson, as a number of the people of his age believed, that after three crossings, as they called it, after three interracial relationships, that the products of these unions became white. Jefferson seems to have treated the Hemings family in Monticello with special favor. Sally Hemings' brother was Jefferson's chef. Other members of the family held important posts in the Jefferson household. They were not field hands or field slaves at all. And so Jefferson has evolving in front of him as a scientist this experiment, if you like to call it that, of these people who are evolving, as far as I think he was concerned, to a higher state of humanity.
We've talked about how the white people at that time regarded these interracial relationships. But what about the black people of that time? How often did these interracial relationships, how often were they what we would nowadays call rape? And how often were they what we might call, at least to some degree, mutual?
Well, I tend to think that in the 18th century, and particularly in this case, because this lasted for 18th and 19th century, because this lasted for 38 years, it's pretty difficult to call this rape. And there is no such thing as consensual sex in the 18th and the 19th century, even for white women, is that you are your husband's property and he can do with you as he pleases. And so in this case, this is not to say that there was not rape. But in this case, I tend to think that that simplifies a much more complex set of interactions. I think that on some level, it was probably the case that there was a genuine affection between Jefferson and this woman.
What about the black community in general? You talked about how the white aristocrats were in denial about this thing that was going on. They knew it was common, but they just didn't talk about it in public. Was there anything like that among black people at this time?
Of course, black people talked about it. And the reason black people talked about it is in many cases, with the exception of one of the exceptions of this union, is that the products of these relationships were always deposited in the black community. I mean, it was not the case that you would find that many of these planters would keep the children of these liaisons in their households. I mean, one case of this is, of course, the case that Martha Washington, the wife of George Washington, had a half-black sister whom she kept in the house and raised as a seamstress. And there are other cases within the Virginia aristocracy where the same thing is going on, and in Southern society generally. And so black people come from slavery, and that's the context under which this is to be understood, with a record of these unions.
How do you think people in America in the late 1700s, the early 1800s, would see America today, where interracial relationships are still very common, but they're now, I guess there are some exceptions in some parts of the country, where they're completely normal, they're open. In fact, our president is the son of a black man and a white woman.
Well, I tend to think that people would probably be shocked by this. I mean, you know, despite the fact of this relationship, many people would have thought it unthinkable that someone of Jefferson's position and Jefferson's learning and supposedly his intellectual and moral discipline would have done this. But I think that there was no cognitive dissonance as far as Jefferson was concerned in terms of this relationship. It's just that he knew that he would have been ruined politically if he had admitted to this.
Clarence Walker is author of the book Mongrel Nation, The America Begotten by Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Why did you choose the phrase mongrel nation for your title? It's such a strong phrase.
Because I do think of America, and I've always thought of it, even before I began to work on this book, as a place where interracial sex was far more common than the dominant narrative of American history has been willing to admit. I mean, I tend to think that the problem, of course, is that most Americans, black, white, or whatever, think that race is color, but race in the United States is blood, and has historically been blood, is that you cannot tell the racial provenance of somebody solely based on their color or pigmentation.
So how has that history, that particular history of interracial relationships in America, how has that influenced how Americans see themselves today when it comes to their racial identity, if they see themselves as having
a
racial identity?
Well, I tend to think that it would be a mistake to think of the country as a post-racial nation. But I think that the country has to and has now finally come around to somehow admitting to the fact that it is a multiracial state and that this is a product that's been in the process for a very long time. That we on the West Coast here in California see this every day. But as you noted earlier, there are lots of parts of the country where this is unusual. It's not necessarily unusual in New York. It's not necessarily unusual in Chicago. It's not necessarily unusual in a place like Seattle or things or other places like that. But there are parts of the country where this is, I think, thought to be verboten, you know.
Are there people or places where Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings are still controversial?
In Virginia.
Yeah.
I think the Virginians are basically, at least some of them, not the black Virginians, but the white Virginians are living in denial. I mean, it's the same way. The same story could be applied, you know, to the late Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, where every black person in South Carolina knew that Strom Thurmond was the father of a black child. It was the white people who kept denying this. You know.
Finally, Clarence, on your UC Davis webpage, your specialties include black American history from 1450 to the present. And I can't help but note that that period starts before Columbus arrived in the United States. What was black American history before Columbus?
Well, I do that because I start in West Africa and I begin with the European contact with the Africans in the 15th century. And trace out the history of blacks through the Middle Passage and the seasoning into North America.
Well, that is surely a fascinating topic in its own right, but I guess we'll have to wait until you write a book on that one.
Well, I do have another book, hopefully in June, called The Preacher and the Politician, Barack Obama and Jeremiah Wright.
Oh, well, that sounds fascinating. I think we can probably book you now.
Okay.
Clarence Walker, author of Mongrel Nation, The America Begotten by Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. The book is published today. He's also a history professor at UC Davis. And I'll note, and let me know if this is still correct, you're going to be exploring Black Christian nationalism in the context of the 2008 presidential election at a free public talk next Wednesday, starting at 12:10 p.m. this afternoon at the UC Davis Shields Library.
Yes.
Excellent. Clarence, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, actor Tyler Coppin takes his internationally acclaimed one-man play to Sacramento. He was born here, but has spent his adult life in Australia. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, it's Furlough Friday, the first day when large numbers of California state employees are taking a mandatory unpaid day off work. A large public sector union protested the furloughs today. Stories on this and more are later today on All Things Considered. An internationally acclaimed one-man play gets its U.S. premiere in Sacramento tomorrow. The show is called Liar Bird, and it's presented by the man who wrote it, Australian actor Tyler Coppin. It's no coincidence Liar Bird gets its American premiere here. Coppin was born and raised in Sacramento, but has spent his adult life down under. He's in our studio with his brother Mitch, who's the producer of this production of Liar Bird. Mitch still lives in Sacramento. Tyler Coppin, Mitch Coppin, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tyler, why did you move to Australia when you were a young man?
Well, I went there on a holiday. I wanted to be an actor, and I didn't know how to go about it. I was at Sac State studying, at Rio Americano studying. And my father called up, and he said, if you come to Australia, I've got to go there for a year for a job. If you come, maybe you can save up and travel the world and then, you know, work out how you're going to be an actor. And while I was there, I auditioned for the National Institute of Dramatic Art, and I got in. I fibbed my way in. Well, I didn't fib. I said they asked me if I could stay. I was only allowed to stay for a year at the time, but it was a 3-year course full time, and I said, yes, I can stay, which was honest enough. And at the end of the first year, they said, we have to make it so that you can stay to complete it. And I did complete it, and 33 years later, I'm still there.
When you started at the school, did it occur to you that you might live there for decades?
No, not at all. I thought I'd do this course, and I thought I'd go back, and I thought I'd go to L.A. or New York, and I'd get work as an actor, and maybe return to Sacramento. But I fell in love. I fell in love with the country, with people, friends, the business, the upcoming Australian film industry and theater there. It's got a wonderful arts culture, and just became Australian. It's just a strange thing. I never would have thought.
Mitch, what did you make of your brother, you know, moving to Australia?
Well, I had the opportunity of staying home. I was 21, and I had the offer of babysitting the house for a year.
Sounds and pretty
at,
good, too.
21, I couldn't refuse that, so I stayed behind.
I heard of massive parties at that house. I was really jealous. I was with my parents in Melbourne at the time. At the time, I was bored and until I got into acting school, and I'd hear these reports of great parties back at home. And Rio Americano high school students tearing the place up.
Yes.
We had a good time.
Mitch, what's it like for you hearing your brother speak so differently from you? Because Tyler, you know, pretty much speaks with an Australian accent.
When we're at home, I think he tends to lose that accent a little bit. I don't know. As an actor, he sometimes has it. It's stronger than others. I think when we're at home, he tends to get back to his American roots, and he loses it a little bit more.
Yeah. Tyler, has it helped you as an actor in Australia that you were born and raised in another country?
Well, had I not changed my accent, and I went about it on purpose, on the advice of a teacher who told me that if you wanted to work as an Australian in Australia, you would have to sound Australian. And they said, go up and talk to one of your other students. So he's in third year. I was in first year, and that student was Mel Gibson. And I went up to Mel and said, "We used to smoke cigarettes on the bus in those days, and on the way to NIDA." And he said, "I wouldn't worry about it." And he didn't really worry about it, but I did. And I thought I'd change it, and I changed it. It was difficult. It's like a ballet dancer changing the way they stand, the way they move. It eventually is just a muscularity thing, but it does come back. And it did help me. It did help me a lot. I think I would have been limited.
You've been a dialect coach for, among other people, Heath Ledger.
I have. That was, they found out eventually, the industry in Australia found out that I was American. So a lot of offshore projects are made over there. American Hollywood films are made in Australia. I think the American public would probably be astounded to know, but so many. And they often need, they put Australian actors in them, and they have me coach them and me sit with headphones on and judge them. One young lad came barefoot to my house one day and knocked on my door. I knew he was coming, but he was 20 years old, and he said, "Hi, I'm Heath Ledger." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'm here to learn an American accent." I brought him in. Heck of a nice guy. He came over from Perth. He had done something before. I taught him, I didn't teach him an accent. I said, "What have you got?" And he went through some lines, and he was so incredibly good. I literally gave him like the good housekeeping stamp of approval and said, "I have nothing to teach you. You're fantastic." And he said, "How much do I owe you?" And I said, "Well, $20. He gave me $20 and left.
How shocking it must have been for you having known him when he passed away so young.
It was awful. It was terrible. It was untimely. It was sad. And it was an accident. And it shows you, and I hope young actors learn from it, that it's such a demanding job, the hours of film acting, any acting at all, and many businesses anyway. You can't sleep, and when you can't sleep and you have a massive schedule and you have a lot of pressure, your temptation is to try to sleep. I want to sleep. I need to sleep. How am I going to do that? And a combination of prescription, non-prescription, painkillers and things is not maybe the best way to go about it.
I'm talking with Tyler Coppin. He's an actor. His internationally acclaimed one-man play, Lyrebird, opens tomorrow night in Sacramento. It's at the 24th Street Theater. There's a preview tonight. He was born in Sacramento, but has spent his adult life in Australia. Also with us is Mitch Coppin, Tyler's brother, who's the producer of this local production of Lyrebird, which actually premiered about 10 years ago in Australia and has played in other countries. Tyler, the full title of the play is Lyrebird. By the way, that's spelled L-Y-R-E. Lyrebird, Tales of Helpman. Who was Helpman?
Robert Helpman was this young boy that was born in 1909 in South Australia, in rural Australia. He was effeminate, effete, and he wanted to be a ballet dancer from an early age. And he told his father, he lived kind of in a farm, basically. And his father said, "You're crazy, you're not going to be one." But he succeeded in doing it and is getting the support of his father and his family. He basically, to make a very long story short, and which is the story of my play, he proceeded to be the partner to Margot Fonteyn, play all the amazing virile male leads during the war era in London. I was great friends with Katharine Hepburn. He basically ended up this very camp, wonderful, eccentric, flamboyant individual, played the virile male leads. He had weedy thighs, a reedy voice, and acted to the billio, as we say, just really acted, and got away with it. Wore pounds of Max Factor, would take the smallest part and turn it into the lead because you couldn't take your eyes off him. So my play is basically about him. It's a dedication to him and a tribute to his life, but it's also my ode to theater. It's about overacting and to be as big as possible and to be as noticed as quickly as you can if you want to be an actor.
Now, you're going to do a short excerpt for us. Anything we need to know before you start it?
Well, he's old. He's old. He's an older man, and he's... he comes forward at the end and he says, it's set at an interval of a matinee at a ballet, and he's about to go on and he says, "How I love a matinee. The crowd is generally older. I suppose it's easier to get a parking spot, what with the early bird special. But quite simply, the most important feature for the elderly is that a matinee ends well before their bedtime, so there's less chance of nodding off in the middle of it and missing out on all of the action. But as the interval draws to an end and I am standing in the wings, ready to resume my place in the fantasy, it always strikes me how my performance that afternoon might possibly be the last piece of theater that many of them will ever see.
Wow, Tyler Coppin, reading his from his one-man play that he wrote himself, and he's the actor in it, Lyre Bird, Tales of Helpman. It gets its U.S. premiere starting tomorrow at the 24th Street Theater in Sacramento. Mitch Coppin, you're the producer of this production. What does that mean?
Well, it was a learning experience, very fast. I saw the play 10 years ago in Melbourne, or in Wellington, New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I thought, other people in Sacramento should have a chance to see this. We have a lot of friends, a lot of family here, and I'd like to see it here someday. And I talked to Tyler for a long time and seen if there was a way to get it here. And finally, I realized that to get it here in Sacramento, I'd really have to step up and try and get it here myself, which I did. And so for the last year and a half, it's been a real learning experience for me, a great opportunity to work with Tyler and find out what it takes to put on a production. So there was a lot of research that went on for about a year before we actually pulled the trigger and brought it on.
Tyler, what was it like for you when you realized that your brother was going to do what it took to bring Lyre Bird to Sacramento?
I had to ask myself, why am I going to do it? It's an incredible amount of work. And I thought one of the main things was to work with Mitch on something. It'd be fun. It's an adventure. It's a risk. Let's do that. And then there's Sacramento that I wanted to do. I'd love to do a play in my home city. You know, I've never worked here. I've only worked really in Australia. So it'd be a great learning curve for both of us to do. And it's just been great. It's been an incredible amount of work. And my wife and my son were here for a while, but they've gone back. That was hard, mixing family and pleasure and Christmas with producing this play, but we've managed to do it with the support of my family back home too.
You're the only actor in it. Is there a lot of costume, a lot of sets and so on that you needed to bring over?
Yes, I wear a wig on top of a wig and costume on top of a costume, and the costume designer was Kim Barrett, and she's a film designer, and it's funny. She was a costume designer for The Matrix, the film with Keanu Reeves. And,
wow!
And we were doing those in Sydney, and I called her up and said, "You want to do this play?" And she did. And she said, "You know, we can use some of the material from The Matrix if we don't tell anybody." I can say this now because they've recouped, so it's fine.
Sure.
So she would literally bring me in between Keanu Reeves' and Lawrence Fishburne's costume calls, and I'd go in there to try on the leather from, you know, the scraps of the floor that she'd make my gloves as Don Quixote from. So there's some of the, I still look at it and I think, this is funny. This is Matrix material that I'm wearing on stage.
And
it's strange. It's all sorts of great little things about this play that I.
Wow. By the way, Mitch, if I might, I note that your day job is you're an IT manager with the state of California. Is this furlough day for you?
This is furlough day for me. Yes,
well,
it is.
That helped us get you in the studio, so I guess that was a good thing.
It was easy to get in here today.
Yes, but it must be tough for people on this furlough day.
Yeah, it is tough with a lot of people, and I feel bad that we're in this situation.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in. Thank you for bringing Lyre Bird to Sacramento. That's Mitch Coppin. His brother, Tyler Coppin, is the actor and the writer of the acclaimed one-man play Lyre Bird, Tales of Helpman. It opens tomorrow night in Sacramento at the 24th Street Theater. Tyler Coppin, Mitch Coppin, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producer was Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe. And thank you for joining us.
Charles.
Charles Darwin's 200th birthday is coming up, also the 150th anniversary of his famous book On the Origin of Species. On the next Insight, we talk with experts about Darwin's work and its impact on science and society. Also, a local poet finishes his final book of Pablo Neruda translations. William O'Daly tells you about World's End, the eighth volume in his two-decade-long Neruda project. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday afternoon at 2 on Capital Public Radio.